Despite congressional support for Israel, Eisenhower still threatened sanctions, and Ben-Gurion ultimately chose to entirely pull out of Sinai through a process of several months. With an American pledge to defend Israel's shipping rights at the Red Sea, this pledge would not stop Nasser from blocking the straits again in 1967. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 213, New York, Washington, and Jerusalem. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. One interesting headline that appeared some decades ago in the New York Times was the following. Koch, angry at UN, would alter Isaiah Wall. The mayor had noticed that on First Avenue, across the street from the United Nations General Assembly, sits what is known as the Isaiah Wall, bearing an inscription of verses from Isaiah describing the end of days, when swords would be beaten into plowshares. Koch told the New York Times that he was so angry at the unfair attacks on Israel leveled in the United Nations that he would seek to add an inscription on the wall, referencing the UN's, quote, hypocrisy, immorality, and cowardice, end quote. The United Nations in New York has long been a locus of anti-Israel sentiment. In contrast, when it comes to another assembly, the Congress of the United States, there, friends of Israel have long been found. The difference between these two assemblies and their respective relationships with Jerusalem was experienced by one man more than any other, a man who shuttled between these two cities and who found himself unexpectedly and suddenly in the spotlight, representing Jerusalem's Israeli government in New York, with the eyes of the world upon him as the Suez battle was launched. It was on October 29, 1956, that Israeli troops landed in the Sinai, with French and British forces soon after taking hold of the Suez. Abba Ibn, serving as both Israeli representative to the United Nations and Israel's ambassador to Washington, had no idea the operation was being planned. When it was launched, Ibn traveled from D.C. to New York, arriving at the General Assembly as it was castigating Israel. He spoke without the text of a written speech, precisely at a time when the television was broadcasting the speeches from inside the assembly. I quote sections of the speech cited in Asaf Siniver's biography of Ibn, to which this episode is indebted. Ibn defended Israel's right to respond to Egyptian aggression, noting that Egypt, as a member of the UN and a signer of an armistice with Israel, was duty-bound to refrain from attacks on Israel, and it had clearly not refrained from engaging in these attacks. Ibn said, quote, is there any resemblance, whatever, between this list of obligations and Egypt's actual conduct of its relations with Israel? Can anyone imagine that if Egypt had been willing to carry out this system of relations with Israel, we should have been assembled here on this tragic and solemn occasion? What we confront tonight is a point of explosion after 8 years of illicit belligerency. Belligerency is the key to the understanding of our problem tonight. Egypt has practiced belligerency against Israel by land. Egypt has practiced belligerency against Israel by sea. Egypt has established belligerency as the judicial basis of its relations with Israel. Egypt has held belligerency to be the spiritual and emotional mainspring of its conduct toward Israel, end quote. So Ibn said. Ibn then made a point that defenders of Israel would continue to make throughout the years, a point ignored by Israel's critics, but a point that is profoundly true, which is, what would Israel's critics say if other countries experienced the assaults that were targeted at Israel? Ibn said, quote, how many other nations have had hundreds of their citizens killed over these years by the action of armies across the frontier? How many nations have had their ships seized and their cargoes confiscated in international waterways? How many nations find the pursuit of their daily tasks to be a matter of daily and perpetual hazard? And he added a bit after, nobody else is in our place and is therefore fully competent to equate the advantage and the disadvantage of our choice. The government of Israel is firmly convinced that it has done what any other nation would have done in our place, with the reservation that many would have done it earlier and with perhaps greater impact of resistance, end quote. This is eloquent enough, but Ibn not only focused on Israel's right to wage war with Egypt, he also spoke of Israel's desire for peace, saying, quote, Israel has no desire or intention to wield arms beyond the limit of its legitimate defensive mission. But whatever is demanded of us by way of restoring Egypt's rights and respecting Egypt's security under international law must surely be accompanied by equally binding Egyptian undertakings to respect Israel's security and Israel's rights under the identical law. Egypt's obligation to abstain from acts of hostility, to liquidate its commando activities, to abolish its illicit discrimination against Israeli shipping in the Suez Canal and in the Gulf of Aqaba is equal and identical in law to Israel's obligation to respect the established armistice lines. Our signpost is not backward to belligerency, but forward to peace. Whatever Israel is now asked to do for Egypt must have its counterpart in Egypt's reciprocal duty to give Israel the plenitude of its rights. Egypt and Israel are two people whose encounters in history have been rich and fruitful for mankind. Surely they must take their journey from this solemn moment towards the horizons for peace." End quote. All this, ladies and gentlemen, Ibn astonishingly said off the cuff with the eyes of the world upon him. As Cinever further reports, John Foster Dulles was overheard saying to Henry Cabot Lodge, the American UN representative, "It's a pity we can't have him instead of you as our delegate here." And the New York Times reported, quote, "Arising from a rolling sea of oratory and invective, the words and manner of the young Mr. Ibn defending the actions of his young country made him one of the television heroes of the United Nations," end quote. Nevertheless, as we mentioned yesterday, the Eisenhower administration was utterly unsympathetic to Israel, and a UN resolution demanding a ceasefire was overwhelmingly passed during the time period that Israel extended its control over the Sinai and Gaza. But what is interesting for one studying the history of American-Israeli relations is the reaction in the Congress. There, as Cinever tells us, 112 members of Congress, quote, "declared their support of Israel's demand to condition the Gaza withdrawal on direct peace negotiations with Egypt," end quote. Especially fascinating is the reaction of members of the Senate. Cinever further tells us, quote, "The Senate submitted a resolution calling on the U.S. government to provide Israel the necessary guarantees against the resumption of Fedayeen attacks from Gaza or of the maritime blockade. There was also criticism of the administration's double standard in its condemnation of Israel, while it refused to demand that the Soviets withdraw their forces from the recently occupied Budapest." Senate Majority Leader Lyndon Johnson wrote to Dulles, "To put it simply, the United States cannot apply one rule for the strong and another for the weak." While Senators William Noland, Republican, and Herbert Humphrey, Democrat, threatened to resign from the American delegation to the UN if the administration carried out the threat of sanctions, end quote. In the midst of all this, John Foster Dulles made his own view about the Jewish people pretty clear, angrily using terrible language to describe congressional and popular American support for Israel. Michael Duran tells us that Dulles complained about what Dulles called the, quote, "terrific control the Jews had over the news media and the barrage which the Jews have built up on congressmen," end quote. Those were Dulles's words. Despite congressional support for Israel, Eisenhower still threatened sanctions, and Ben-Gurion ultimately chose to entirely pull out of Sinai through a process of several months, with an American pledge to defend Israel's shipping rights at the Red Sea. This pledge would not stop NASA from blocking the Straits again in 1967. As Duran further reports, it seems that years later, Eisenhower regretted the stance he had taken against Israel. We have mentioned the story of Eisenhower's meeting with American Jewish leader Max Fisher, in which he expressed this regret, and, as Michael Duran adds, further evidence can be found from a record in 1967, after Nasser blocked the Straits, and Israel's ambassador to the U.S., Avram Harman, visited Eisenhower at his home in Gettysburg, reporting back to Israel about Eisenhower that, quote, "in his reflections on the past, he still regretted the fact that they failed to establish a clear status with respect to the Suez Canal as they had done with respect to the Straits," end quote. This, as Duran writes, highlights Eisenhower's regret for not showing greater support for the position of Israel and Britain and France, end quote. Isaiah's prediction of the end of war has not yet been fulfilled, but some of the miracles described by Isaiah, a return of the Jewish people to the Holy Land and to the beloved city of Jerusalem, the blooming of the wilderness, these miracles have come to be. Meanwhile, across from the Isaiah wall today, anti-Israel sentiment still festers at the UN. And today, of course, one can also find in Washington those that will peddle tropes against Israel and the Jewish people, such as those uttered by Dulles. But one will also find in Washington, thank God, friends of Israel and the Jewish people who see in the Jewish state a sign of the miracles described in Isaiah, a sign of the chosenness of the Jews made manifest in the Sinai desert so long ago. It is to this miracle of Sinai to which we shall turn in our special pre-Shavuot episode tomorrow. This is Meir Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together on Erev Shavuot, signing off.